You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Stasi Poetry Circle, it sort of sounds a little bit like a joke. It's a bit Monty Python, but I felt I wanted to sort of tell a story that brought out the comic as well as the horrific aspect of that absurdity.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. In 1982, the East German Ministry for State Security is hunting for creative new weapons in the war against the class enemy. And their solution is stranger than fiction. Rather than guns, tanks or bombs, the Stasi develop a program to fight capitalism through rhyme and verse, winning the culture war through poetry, and the result is the most bizarre book club in history. I speak with Philip Altman, the author of the Stasi Poetry Circle. Philip has used unseen archival material and exclusive interviews with surviving members to tell the incredible hidden story of a unique experiment weaponizing poetry for politics. Now, if you think there's a vast army of research assistants, audio engineers and producers putting together this podcast, you'd be wrong. The podcast relies on your support to enable me to continue to capture these incredible stories and make them available to everyone for free.
Hi, this is Tree from Berlin. I decided to support Cold War Conversations with a monthly subscription for a couple of reasons. I believe it's so important and interesting to hear these stories from that period, good and bad. Books will tell you so much, but the real life stories from people who were there make it so real. Sometimes you feel like you are there experiencing these times in history.
If you'd like to help me to preserve Cold War history and enable me to continue to produce this podcast, you can via a one-off or monthly donation. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more details. You can also join our Facebook discussion group where the Cold War conversation continues between episodes. Just search Cold War Conversations in Facebook. I'm delighted to welcome Philip Altman to our Cold War conversation. This book intrigued me. Stasi is always a popular subject amongst the listeners, but poetry wasn't the word that I was expecting to be linked to the Stasi, but we'll get into that in a moment. I think the best way to start this is to almost go back to the beginning of the GDR, and I wanted to ask you about the GDR and their policies towards arts and culture.
I think this is a sort of an aspect of East Germany that, even to me as a German, I was born in West Germany. I was born in 1981, so I was very young when the war fell. But even to me, growing up in Germany, literature or the cultural tradition of East Germany was one that I wasn't very aware of. I think East German culture isn't something that has been absorbed into the reunited Germany very well. It's often been sidelined. So I think this is a sort of the story of how much culture mattered to East Germany was one that I only discovered while researching this book, and I felt was worth telling, and I felt was best told in a way by the story of an expressionist poet called Johannes Becher, who was a communist. He was in exile during the Nazi era, and he returned after the end of the Second World War. And he, to him, I think he very much believed that the sort of the Nazi era at its worst was summed up by the Nazis' treatment of culture. that Germany had this incredible cultural heritage, this tradition of Kultur, of high thinking, of great writing and a great philosophy that they had kicked into the dust. And he very much saw it as the mission of East Germany to build a state that would give due respect to this culture. And I think one of the interesting things is that, to an extent, they listened. I mean, Becher was one of a sort of coterie of poets, most of them former expressionists, which may or may not be significant, who were then actually given functions in this state as ministers, as ambassadors, and so on. And in the really early phase of East Germany being built up, there was a sort of, you know, to an extent, artists and writers had a privileged status. Some of them got special food vouchers. I think there were sort of special stores where they could shop, where only the intelligentsia could shop. But Becher was made culture minister, and he had this idea. I mean, he wrote in very utopian terms about what he believed East Germany should do. That it would be a state where culture would have the standing of a Großmacht, of a supreme power. It would be equal to politics, rather than being instrumentalized by politics. That was his idea, and he developed this his thinking went into sort of channels that actually policymakers could use. So the Marxist way of thinking about labor was that there was a under capitalism, there was a division of labor that trapped people in doing one specialized job. And the supposed great promise of communism was that under communism, these divisions would fall away and people could do as they wished. They could do, as Marx, I think, said, I'm slightly summarizing, paraphrasing here, but they could herd cattle in the morning and then write philosophical essays in the evening. So even though Johannes Becher died of cancer in the early 60s, his ideas in this respect of how this new state should treat culture did find their way into policymaking. So there was a program named after the town of Bitterfeld, where there was a cultural summit, which is called this program was called the Bitterfelder Weg, the Bitterfeld Path, and that program foresaw that there would be writing circles in every branch of industry or in every factory. And that writers would come in to these factories, they would work there, but also teach the workers how to write. So to achieve this perfect balance between brawn and brain, between writing and working, and to sort of cross the divide between the proletariat and the intelligentsia. So that was the sort of, I think, one utopian, but at the beginning, at least, quite serious mission statement that was part of the founding years of East Germany.
From my sort of reading of the book, the GDR really thought that art and culture brought out the best in people, and certainly I remember from visiting East Germany in the late 1980s, the subsidies that were thrown at concert halls and theatres were massive to be able to, you know, allow the greater population to experience arts and culture at a very affordable price.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there were tickets, you know, designated for workers, for each factory would receive theater tickets that it could allocate to workers. There was a decree passed that made sure that every factory of a certain size had a library. You know, if it had X amount of workers, it would have to be a part-time librarian. Once it had more than 1,000 workers, it would have to have a full-time librarian. So this was really, you know, it took literature incredibly seriously.
Beckard is probably more known to the listeners of Cold War Conversations as the guy who wrote the lyrics for the East German national anthem.
That's right. Yeah, I mean that was his. I mean, I think one of the remarkable things I found is, I mean, Becher isn't a household name anymore in Germany. It certainly wasn't to me, and certainly isn't to anyone younger than me. And what I found is that while he was someone who was in every library, in every bookshop, on display in East Germany, he also wasn't read very passionately by anyone I met. I think there was a, you know, he had his political influence was perhaps greater than his literary legacy.
Well, let's get on to the sort of the crux of the story, which is the Stasi decide that they want to also have a writing circle alongside, you know, the factories and all the other enterprises in East Germany. And this was called the Working Circle of Writing Czechists, which hardly rattles off the tongue, but I was delighted to see The Guardian had headlined it as the Red Poets Society in the best tabloid style almost. But can you just tell us what was a Czechist?
So Czechist is how the Stasi internally referred to itself, because it was the Stasi had modelled itself on the Cheka, on the Soviet Russian secret police, and it very much had, you know, its own mythology. It paid homage to Soviet Russia's secret police. So the paramilitary compound in East Berlin, where poetry, this Red Poet Society, the writing Czechists, where they met, was the Felix Dzerzhinsky Regiment, the Wachregiment, Felix Dzerzhinsky being the founder of the Cheka. So yes, the Stasi got in on this program pretty early on in the 1960s, in a slightly haphazard, sporadic fashion, I would say. From what I could glean from the archives, there were sort of irregular meetups throughout the 60s and 70s in this Guards regiment compound in Adlershof. They had a culture house. I mean, it was quite a vast regiment with all sorts of amenities, including a house of culture. And there seemed to have just been sort of lyrical evenings where people read out some of their poems, and that was it. There was the odd anthology published. I think two, one in the 1960s and one in the 70s, but really just on a, it's just, I mean, I saw the booklet. It's quite a flimsy little booklet. Some of them haven't even got the poets' names in them, and the poems are sort of, I mean, yeah, like pretty, they're not even political, which is, I mean, you'd expect them perhaps to be political, but at that stage, they weren't. I mean, a lot of them are just love poems, some of them slightly comical, border guards dreaming of writing I love you into the night sky with their searchlights, or one poet talking about his love and how he wishes that his love he says, I want you to be mine, just mine, and I hope my love will never be nationalized or collectivized. So, I mean, certainly not taking the state's official ideology very seriously at that stage. So yeah, this is that. It was something that they did sporadically until something happened in the 1980s. From what you can see in the files, suddenly they started taking it very seriously from around 1982. And that's sort of where the story got interesting to me, because I was trying to work out why.
What happened in that period that made them take it more seriously? Because they tried to sort of professionalize the circle a bit more, didn't they?
Yeah, so they in 1982, the Stasi approached this widely published professional poet called Uwe Berger, and they asked him to run this circle because they felt they wanted to, officially in the files, they said they wanted to improve the quality of the works produced in this circle. And the whole thing acquires a bit more rigor. They meet for the next 7 years. They meet once a month for 2 hours from 4 to 6 in the same building. These sort of lessons have a clear structure where the Stasi men come in and read out their poems, and Uwe Berger, their teacher, gives them some feedback on the formal structure of how you structure a poem. It teaches them what a rhyme is, what is a cross rhyme, what is free verse, what is iambic pentameter, what is meter, and so on. So yeah. something happens, and it's not. I mean, you could just. I mean, one explanation would just be that it's, you know, perhaps it was continuous with the great utopian vision of Johannes Becher, and that this was a state that would, the way even the secret police would take art very seriously. And why would you not have some offer? I mean, this was a paramilitary compound for people whose private lives were well, the Stasi was a little bit nervous about their private lives of its own staff, because they didn't want them to mingle with everyday folk, and they certainly didn't want them to be tempted by contact with people from the West. So they needed to provide some sort of entertainment, and why not let that be a poetry workshop? That's the innocent explanation.
And were they, you know, looking to use these poems as a form of propaganda or anything like that? Or was it purely sort of just to keep the Stasi folk entertained and to try and get them more interested in highbrow literature?
One thing that I found striking is, so this teacher, Uwe Berger, he sort of seemed to have fallen back on a parallel idea from the founding years of East Germany about what the relationship between literature and politics should be. So I mentioned Becher before, the idea that art and politics should be equal partners. And then you had another important poet, Friedrich Wolf, who became East Germany's ambassador to Poland, another staunch communist. But Friedrich Wolf had a slightly different idea of what that relationship was. Basically, he said, I mean, he famously coined the phrase "Kunst ist eine Waffe," art is a weapon. And he said it's the job of the artist to forge this weapon from the iron of the age, and the proletariat has to pick this up. So basically, he said art has to be is a tool. It is a weapon. So he believed that. That you know, that relationship was a little bit less equal, and Berger seems to have fallen back on this idea that he very much believed that poems had to be sort of almost like marching songs. They had to rouse the emotion. They had to inspire belief in the Soviet Union, belief in Marxism, and sort of foster hatred towards the class enemy. So that's what I think comes out from what the files I saw, that he had a slightly different, less utopian perhaps, idea of what poetry should do. I mean, that he did to an extent. I mean, it sounds like a joke to say that poetry could be a secret weapon, but this idea that art is a weapon, it did swing through East German history. It was a sort of phrase that was used again and again and again by the Stasi. Friedrich Wolf, whose son Markus Wolf, of course, became East Germany's most famous spy master. Friedrich Wolf wrote a pamphlet, a portrait, a sort of an ode to Felix Dzerzhinsky that was distributed around to everyone who was in this paramilitary unit, and which contained that idea that art is a weapon. So the question is, what was this weapon, directed against? What was it meant to do? Because these poems were not published. There was, it wasn't like the case that they wrote poems that they were then read out on radio or handed out to every household in East Germany. That wasn't the case. These were...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Produced for Stasi consumption, these poems. They were they're printed a couple of anthologies, but they were printed at 1,500 copies or something, so they weren't meant to be for population at large. So if art or poetry was a weapon, this isn't something that the Stasi spelt out in its files, but I think it's pretty there's certainly evidence for what this circle ended up being used for.
I think it's interesting because the West did use culture to some degree as a sort of a weapon as well. I mean, the CIA were financing front cultural organizations to try and portray the West as, a utopian society around culture as well, perhaps not in the way of getting their soldiers to write poems and form writing circles. But, I think culture, the battleground of culture through the Cold War is an interesting story that I've not really investigated that much.
There were journals all around the world, often beautifully designed literary journals, which attracted some quite, attracted or they deliberately brought in some quite high profile literary figures of the sort of center left. I think the CIA had a sort of an idea there to was engaged in a similar culture war that was perhaps more covert. I mean, the Stasi spelt it out what they wanted to do in East Germany. It was interesting because in 1966, this Congress for Cultural Freedom that was sponsored by the CIA is unmasked. In the New York Times, they reveal that it was a sort of front organization. But if you look at the mentions in the East German newspapers that I looked at, I was just struck by how they, that was the line from the beginning. these sort of cultural propaganda efforts became perhaps less influential. There was this German literary magazine, Der Monat, which was, after the scandal was ended, then relaunched, but it wasn't very influential. So by the 1980s, when the Stasi suddenly re-embarks on this culture war, and it becomes very convinced that, there are these internal reports that are produced by the Stasi's own think tank, where they decide that anyone who works in the culture sector is extremely susceptible to infiltration or attempts of by the West to be sort of to be lured over into their way of thinking. Even though at this point, I could not find any known sign, any records of that being a concerted effort on the behalf of the West. It seemed to be more of a case of a sort of growing paranoia in East Germany in the 1980s.
You know, there's a lot of little nuggets in this book, which I really enjoyed. And one of the ones that I did pick out was, and I wasn't aware of this, was this thing called the Little Political Dictionary, where the GDR are trying to attempt to control the language that's used within East German society. So this is one of the, because one of the phrases in there is one that I've heard before, is the, you know, calling the Berlin Wall the anti-fascist rampart.
Yeah, the anti-fascist protection wall or whatever. Yeah. Schutzwall. Yeah, it's a fascinating little document. Do you want me to get it off my shelf?
I'd love to see it, definitely. Yeah.
Das kleine politische Wörterbuch. Yeah, the little.
Wow, it's a chunky. It's huge.
Yeah, very.
Wow.
It's not just a little guidebook with a couple of key words. I mean, it just tries to reformulate the meaning of any word you can imagine. And sometimes to an absurd degree. I mean, yeah, the war was sort of redefined. It defines peace as something that essentially is only pursued by the East. There's an entry on what a political opposition is, and it says there's something that they have in capitalist societies, but in socialist or communist societies, you don't need to have a political opposition because all these conflicts have already been resolved, and the workers are in charge and in charge of the means of production, so you don't need an opposition. So, I mean, there are these sort of little mini arguments that are sort of like, hey. it's a fascinating little document, and just in it, because it shows you that there was a sort of struggle for what words meant that was going on under the surface. And I think that's something that's really interesting also about the Stasi. I think, you know, the Stasi, when it is built up after the Second World War, it tries to recruit predominantly people from working class backgrounds. And Erich Mielke deliberately says, I don't want clever people I don't want know-alls. I want people who deliver results, you know, who can fight battles and win them. And that's a sort of recruitment policy at the beginning. It's also then very paranoid about these people with their clever degrees and learnedness. And I think that's one thing that is also important to understand about East Germany, that it was a very literary society, but it was also perhaps because it was constantly referencing canonical texts, not just in literature, but also in politics. It was referencing Marx. It was, the writings of Lenin. But these were sort of origin core texts. And then you had a political class that was the authorized interpreters of these texts. Mm. So whenever there were intellectuals or people who could read the same text and get a different meaning out of it, that was very unsettling and subversive, and something that the Stasi in particular was sort of just, I think, quite paranoid about, which is why it pursued Marxists who just wanted a different kind of Marxism, but also why it became increasingly nervous about what these writers were doing, which it didn't understand sometimes. I mean, so this think tank, it's a very Western word, but I'm just going to use it. It produces a sort of report on these literati, and it sort of just says, you know, these people, they employ these sort of camouflaged techniques like metaphors and fables, which you know, just standard techniques. I mean, that's what creative writing is, but, you know, in itself, creative writing became suspicious.
One of the other aspects I enjoyed in the book was that you did explore some of the lives of people who were not directly involved in the state. And I found particularly interesting the story of Annegret Gollin and how the Stasi pursued her. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think she was someone whose story I sort of came across by accident while I was researching this book, and I spent a lot of time. So I tracked down people who were in this circle. I tracked down poems from the Stasi Records archive. I tracked down their files, their CADA files, and so on. But I was sort of quite aware that I was, in a way, only telling one side of the story, which was the story of the perpetrators or the people with power. And I sort of needed to understand, get a better idea of their victims. And so this woman, Anna Gregoline, just struck me as a really interesting character because she, in a way, she was very normal. I mean, she was just someone who wrote poems as a student. Well, I mean, you know, when she was still at school, she was someone who wrote a lot, and she was someone who got into trouble with her teachers, with her parents, and increasingly with sort of other authorities as well. But in normal circumstances, this would have not been an undue problem. But she was eventually arrested and put into prison over a collection of poems that weren't even published. So these were poems that she had copied out into her little notebooks and given to some friends whose parents were in the Stasi and passed these poems on to the Stasi. And after she was arrested, she was interviewed dozens and dozens of times about the meanings of these poems, which is just seems so utterly absurd because they're sort of like punk lyrics or something. I mean, they're just, she's angry with the country that she lives in, but that somehow the state deemed it, the state that was so afraid of someone like this that they would put her into prison over this. I mean, there were other reasons why the Stasi was interested in her. I mean, she was sort of part of a youth subculture of young kids who like to go hitchhiking around East Germany and go to rock and blues concerts and wore long hair and flares. And some of them didn't want to work, which was, always a bit of a sore point for the workers' paradise of East Germany that promised to guarantee work to everyone, but it didn't quite know what to do with people that didn't want to work. So there were other reasons, perhaps, why the Stasi was sort of interested in her and saw her as a troublemaker. But the fact that in the end it was these poems that she was charged over just seemed so. So utterly absurd also because, she seemed to be, like many of these dissident writers, I mean, not them, most of them didn't want to be dissidents, but many of them were entirely in keeping with the sort of utopian idea, philosophy of East Germany that Becher had tried to articulate and really believed in that writing did good.
I think her story is particularly tragic because you mention about retirement that her pension, because she had been prevented from working by the Stasi as well, because her profession, I think, was working in bookstores and booksellers, that her pension would be half of what a Stasi employee would get today.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of ongoing problem that... the last government tried to address, but it hasn't really fixed. But I mean, a lot of people who fell foul of the state were discriminated against, often at an early age, in a way that meant they weren't allowed to do the job that they had wanted to do or were even qualified to do. So there were people who were very talented academics or were talented doctors, for example, but because they were members, they were of the church, they weren't allowed to practice. And there are many, many people who ended up doing menial jobs that they, even though they were qualified to do something else. There's an argument that these people should get compensated for that. Because they can't, now that many of them are coming to retirement, they don't get the pension in a way that they deserve. But because the Stasi's treatment of these people meant they didn't always write this down, or the files that show this treatment don't always survive, means that they really struggle to meet the legal requirements. And you sometimes just, there's a vast bureaucratic apparatus nowadays that they're sometimes run by West Germans who really don't understand that old system in the East. And then you have, you have people who were denied work opportunities, but you also have others who were basically, who were victims of psychological warfare, essentially, on behalf of the Stasi, what the Stasi called Zersetzung, and these people, where the Stasi systematically destabilized them by eroding their trust in the people closest to them. So, where they sort of deliberately recruited people around them. And some of these people just, they are physically and psychologically really unwell. But how do you prove that? How do you prove that in a court that you were disadvantaged like that, and the disability that you may have is due to something the Stasi did? Especially in West German courts, that's really difficult. So Anna Grigolini, I felt that story was sort of really important to tell, because this, as you said at the beginning, Stasi Poetry Circle, it sort of sounds a little bit like a joke, or it's a bit Monty Python. But I felt I wanted to sort of tell a story that brought out the comic as well as the horrific aspect of that absurdity.
It's well worth reading the detail that you have there about Anna Grit. So in the 1980s, the Stasi is, as you say, trying to get more professionalized. And they also decide they need more people familiar with poetry, because they're worried about subversion with even officially published poems, about people sort of just inserting like hidden messages into poems.
Yeah, I think, largely that paranoia was paranoia. And then there's the odd case where you had East German writers who were deliberately playing with the censors. So there's a famous example of a poet called Uwe Kolbe, who wrote a very, very long poem, and it arrived at the censor's office, and they scrutinized it and probably thought it was a bit impenetrable, but it didn't seem dangerous. And then it gets published in a journal, and then people start noticing that if you take the first letter of every line, another poem, a secret poem, emerges. Do you want me to read it out?
Yeah, let's hear an excerpt. This will be a first, having a poem read out on Cold War Conversations.
So the poem that Uwe Kolbe's poem from 1981, which had a sort of secret poem hidden inside it. It goes, your measures are miserable, your demands enough for bootlickers. Your formerly blood red flag blows into a sluggish belly. To the victims of your heroism, I dedicate an orgasm. May you mighty old men be torn apart by the daily revolution. So there were instances like that where actually people were inserting hidden messages. And that was something that I think the Stasi was getting nervous about. In at least one instance, this Stasi poetry circle became a sort of recruitment ground for specialist informants that the Stasi wanted to have, and wanted to basically train in reading poetry and then pluck into East Germany's literary scene to have someone who could spy on it really well. So there was one member, a very talented young guy who was in this circle, who did then after his he was actually a soldier doing his sort of his military service in this regiment, but then afterwards is recruited as an informant while he mingles with other writers.
He's seen by Berger as being quite talented, isn't he? Is this Alexander Ruka?
Yeah, so this is a character called Alexander Ruka, his poems just sort of stood out to me in these anthologies because they were better than the others. I mean, a lot of this, a lot of them are awful. A lot of them are really awful poems. but his sort of seemed to be interesting. And I don't mean in a sort of musical sense necessarily, but in the sense that they had interesting ideas in them. They had little contradictions in them. They had little metaphors in them. And he was technically accomplished as well. So he wrote a poem, which is really, it's a description of a monument outside Lviv. And it's a monument to the Red Riders. And it's a sort of vast bronze sculpture. But he describes it in an incredibly vivid way where you by the end of the poem, you feel you're on horseback riding with these, with the Red Cavalry. I was just struck by so Ruka stood out to me, and then I interviewed, got other people from this group to talk to me, and they all said, he was the really talented guy. Or our teacher seemed to think he was the really talented guy because he just loved that poem. He never praised us, but he loved this particular poem. And that seemed sort of interesting to me. And I was sort of trying to work out why that may have been, until it sort of looked to me from the files later that that he was actually being, that praise was also a way to sort of groom him a little bit to through praise to bring him into the fold. So Ruka was someone I tried to contact for a long time, and he never really got back to me. I mean, the interesting thing that I could see that even though he clearly had talent, the only thing that I could find with his name was a detective. So he basically privatized himself after the fall of the wall and became a private eye for a bit and had a sort of detective agency, or which also did security for buildings. So I had an address and I had an email, and I tried and dropped off letters and emailed him and rang him, but he never got back until I then sort of thought I'd go the other way and see, can I find the people he spied on, or he was set to spy on. And were there, I eventually struck gold in that I found a met up with a novelist called Gerd Neumann who had remembered that when I told him the story, that yes, there was someone who drove, he took a taxi from Berlin to Leipzig. And he said halfway through about half an hour into the taxi journey, he realized that this guy was not just a taxi driver, he was a spy asked to spy on him. And that's true. There's a report at the end of it. And he said, this guy is your Alexander Ruka guy. I remember. So I suddenly had this other, it was like having a sort of other camera. I mean, it was, weirdly writing a book like this, you end up feeling a bit like you're doing espionage. I suddenly had I had the other guy in the car pointing. And so I had a different account. And,
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com donate to find out more.
What was interesting was the sense that I got from that meeting was that Rurika was a sense that I'd already got from the poems, that he was quite torn between wanting to be a spy and really wanted to be a writer. That was sort of confirmed by what was sort of gone on in this taxi journey. I mean, you know, by the end he'd agreed to give this writer some poems so he could publish in a journal. And even the Stasi was quite invested in this. It sort of followed this up for months afterwards, saying, "Did you get those poems published?" I sort of felt, okay, maybe this I can get Rurika to agree to talk to me. And so I asked the novelist to write a letter to. I said, "You know, how about you? How about we meet up, the three of us, and have a little reunion?" This taxi journey had taken place in 1987, and so we met in first time in 2018, or maybe it was 2019. We met at a restaurant on the outskirts of Berlin, it was a very interesting conversation to sort of try and that I think by the end felt like it had sort of bridged the divide between victims and perpetrators a bit. Or
there's plenty of characters in this book. I mean, one of the ones that did come out quite strongly to me was this period of the 1980s when the Pershing and cruise missiles were being deployed by NATO and the Soviets had the SS-20. And there was obviously alarm in Europe, but also in East Germany. And one of the Stasi employees actually writes a poem which isn't strictly sticking to the correct ideological lines.
This is a young officer in the Stasi's propaganda unit called Gerd Knauer. And he was a smart guy. I mean, he was sometimes a little bit too smart for his own good, I would say. I mean, he got away with it. I mean, he was maybe a little bit, yeah, he knew that he was also a decent writer and he could write well. East Germany's official line, if you look in the little political dictionary, is that, peace is something that is the official policy, is peace of the East German regime. So you don't need a peace movement because the party already provides the peace. And yet there is a sort of, there's a peace movement, sort of mainly grows around Protestant church in East Germany. People organize little marches. It's all a little bit smaller, but it's not something that the state is that tolerates. You know, and East Germany is sort of more. It doesn't want to admit that anyone could be scared in this game of Cold War chess. And yet, Gerd Knauer at this time writes a long, mad poem, 52 pages long, called The Bang, which is about nuclear war. It starts with a loud bang, and suddenly the world is on fire. And it's a sort of strange science fiction apocalyptic tale of a narrator who then becomes Odysseus and runs through history, and their mountains of dead corpses and bones. People become the survivors, start cannibalizing each other, and eat stew made out of nuclear bugs. I mean, it's pretty bizarre, but it has some interesting. I mean, it says I'm scared. You know, their line says this. You know, it's an expression of fear, which is something that the regime didn't want to admit that its citizens had, and certainly the Stasi wasn't meant to be actually in this balance of fear to show that it was scared. And there's a really interesting little section. I mean, again, highly strange, this poem. The narrator runs into an ivory tower where suddenly there are all these German and Greek philosophers who sit there, and they're all a bit like, oh, I don't have an answer. It's the end of the world. I can't give you an answer. And then it says one guy, a man with a beard, gets up, and it's Marx, and he shakes his head and says, well, I think they're doing it because of me. So he reads out this poem in the circle. I mean, there was one woman, as far as I could tell, who attended this circle. She got up after he read it and ran to the toilet to throw up because it was so disgusting, some of the detail in the poem. And Uwe Berger, the teacher, sort of says, you know, it's very technically accomplished. Mm-hmm, that's interesting. Okay. yes. Well, we'll talk. You know, thank you. That's the end of the lesson. And so the interesting thing is that Uwe Berger wrote a report on this poem where he scrutinized some of the aspects, particularly this bit about Marx, and where he says that sort of the question of guilt is not answered unambiguously. He says, our own people are suggesting that if there's a nuclear war, it's because of Marxism. Mm. This is turned out to be one of the other functions of the Stasi poetry circle, that the guy seemingly innocently brought in to just teach them about verse was actually ended up spying on the spies as the spies turned our poets.
Yeah, so it's the classic, the watchers watching the watchers there. And I found Berger a surprising character because he wasn't even a member of the party either, was he?
It's a really strange, he was a really intriguing character. I mean, he died in 2014, so I never got to speak to him. He was confronted with his involvement with the Stasi before he died, and he confessed it. Even wrote a memoir where he says, yeah, I did it. But he sort of downplayed his activity. He was part of that, you know, what in Germany is known as the Flakhelfer Generation. So the teenagers who were drafted into the war machine in the last days of the Third Reich and were made to man or hold anti-aircraft machine guns. So he was still a teenager when he was drafted into the war effort. And it seems to have, like many of that generation, it seems it traumatized them. And he that's certainly how his story, I mean, he wrote about this experience in memoirs, but also in his poetry, and he makes it sound very much like that sort of made it impossible for him to ever join a political organization or you know, having been traumatized by this experience or bullied into the army, which he describes as a very inhumane, I mean, you know, it says he writes a lot about the horrible treatment that the soldier amongst soldiers and how they all bullied each other and beat each other, or beat the older ones, beat the younger ones. And so that sort of seemed to have been his explanation for not joining the Socialist Unity Party, which seemed to have been pretty much mandatory for anyone else who wanted to attain an official function in East Germany. And yet Uwe Berger was not only a, you know, highly prolific poet, but he had all sorts of functions within the these literary societies in East Germany, and then he's asked to come into the Stasi and to teach these poems these spies how to write poetry, and he agrees. Well, so it turned out that all the while he was not a member of the party, he was in fact one of the Stasi's most prolific and productive informants on the literary scene.
And there's no real evidence that he was coerced into.
No, I mean not from the files. And I mean, he in his memoirs he makes it sound He says, you know, oh, I had, he sort of makes it sound as if he had these red lines where he would do no proactive approaches. He would merely report on what he was doing anyway. But if that was the case at the beginning, it certainly wasn't by the end of his activity. I mean, he borrowed manuscripts from friends who were also writers and handed them, you know, straight to the Stasi, or copied them out, handed them to the Stasi, and then gave them back. Mm. He wrote about the films that his friends were watching with their children at home, the jokes that they told. He eventually even proposed sort of put downs that the Stasi could use to sideline writers that he didn't think were ideologically on board,
or rivals to him possibly as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think that would, I mean, to me that would explain, or that explained his success to a degree, because from what I could tell, his books weren't, personally, I didn't like his poem. I didn't understand why he was so widely published, because his poetry was just really dull to me. And then I thought maybe that's just my taste and it's a sort of cultural gap. But then, you know, I read that he wasn't well reviewed. His books didn't sell. I looked in the publisher's archive, his books didn't sell. And it turned out, I mean, certainly by the 80s, his editors there hated him too. I mean, they just thought his poems, his books were awful. And they said, you know, these were socialists and Marxists, but they were of a different generation. And to them, he was just an old sentimental sort of someone who just had a very simple worldview where the Soviet Union was good and everything else was bad. And yeah. They said, that's, we can't publish this anymore. So what does he do? He writes a report on his editor to the Stasi, and then the book gets published. And then he writes a memoir he wrote two memoirs, but in the second one, published after the fall of the wall, he writes a little bit about this Stasi activity. And then he makes it sort of sound as if, okay, well, then I grew tired of, you know, this work. Is, you know, he says, as an artist, I cannot be confronted with the negative aspects of life all the time. So after, he said, I had enough. And I said, I want to thank you. I've enjoyed my time working for you as an informant, but I've had enough. And then he makes it sound like he, the Stasi, and said, oh, well, why don't you run this poetry circle? Only he then starts spying again on the people in the Stasi and writes reports on their poems, questioning the meanings of their poems, whether they perhaps are trying to suggest that they want to escape over to the West, when one writes a poem about flying a kite, and he says, well, that could be a metaphor for trying to escape from our beautiful socialist state. I think that was the sort of the reversal that, to me, gave this research project some structure. There was an interesting reversal in it.
So as the GDR starts to implode in the late 80s, what happens to the working circle of the writing Czechists?
So I mentioned before that the writing Czechists, before they, Uwe Berger came in to turn it into a professional outfit, it was sort of a bit sporadic, a bit ramshackle, and it was run by an officer who had, I mean, his poems were, he loved poems that rhymed. They were sort of very jolly little ditties. They were always, he seemed a very sort of fun character who loved quite trivial poetry. But I was struck, so one of the poems that I find, so as you get to the point where you start to have these liberal reforms around the Soviet bloc, not least in Russia itself, but also in Hungary, in Poland, in the Czech Republic, there's suddenly all this movement. This solid block starts to have movement. And it seems that to East Germans in particular, because they were so loyal, they were the most sort of loyal satellite state. This is a very confusing and disorientating time, and it suddenly shows up in the poetry. Even before you have, I mean, there's one guy who writes a sort of stream of consciousness poem about fear of nuclear war and so on. So that gets a little bit interesting. The tone changes there. But this guy, this officer who used to be the most trivial and fun-loving of the lot, suddenly writes a poem that just suddenly has a really dark turn. I mean, it's a poem that is called Don't Get Yourself in a Spin. And it sort of seems to just a poem about depression, about feeling that the world is turning and he can't keep up. And he can't get anywhere. Nothing is still. Everything is crumbling. So that's something sort of interesting is showing up in this time. And yet, so the Stasi decides it wants to produce another anthology of poems for the 40th anniversary of the GDR in 1989. And Uwe Berger is charged with editing it, and he picks these poems. And I mean, the interesting thing is that these are all the poems from that period are in sort of one file in the archive, but you can see which ones were made it into the final edition and which didn't. And so you can see that he was sort of trying to block out the doubt and the confusion and the alienation, and was just focusing on these sort of marching songs, essentially. Again, the anthology is called With My Raised Fist, I think, or In My Raised Fist. It's sort of like everything is on track. The war is going to be up for
nothing's for, going wrong. Nothing's look the other way. Nothing to see.
Nothing to see. but clearly, yeah, clearly it wasn't. I mean, so this anthology, There's a permission for it to get printed, but even after the fall of the wall, but it never makes its way to the printer.
You mentioned earlier about the Stasi being certainly Becker being fond of sonnets and certain types of poem. Did the Stasi have a view on limericks?
I think they would have. I have not found a Stasi limerick.
That's a shame.
And if I do find one, I will give you the exclusive on the Cold War Conversations podcast. That would have been lovely. I mean, I was trying to think whether there's any. I mean, limericks are usually a bit dirty, aren't they? And scatological or sexual. I'm just trying to think whether they had. I mean, there was a bit of love poetry going on, but I don't think there's. I mean, supposedly the thing that one of the things that Berger didn't like was that in these poetry circles and factories, the workers wrote these poems that were just about sex and shitting. one report claimed, and so I think he was making sure if anyone did write a poem like that, they would be kicked out. So no limericks, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I can live with that disappointment. The book is called The Stasi Poetry Circle. We are doing a book giveaway with this episode. We're going to have three copies to give away. Details of how to be in the chance to win one will be in the episode notes. So do make sure you check that out. But it's well worth a read. There's some fascinating stories in there. I learned a lot about poetry. Iambic pentameters, was it?
Iambic, yeah.
iambic pentameters. I'm not known for my pronunciation on this podcast, so it's not surprising I got that wrong. But some incredible characters in there and some amazing stories that I certainly hadn't heard before and didn't know about. So if you're interested in East Germany and the Stasi, this is an angle that you've definitely never heard before. Lucky listeners can win one of three free copies of the book by checking out our prize draw, which is detailed in the episode notes. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.